June 22nd, and we are in the Sheraton Hotel at West Palm Beach, Florida. Okay, this is Eldon Orker. When were you born, Mr. Orker?
I was born September 21st, 1910.
And where?
In North Cater, Kansas.
Oh, same as Walter Johnson, at least same state.
Yeah, he's in the same state.
Very good. Was he one of your idols growing up, perhaps?
No, when I was growing up, I didn't know very much about professional baseball. I never followed it because we were too far out in the West. We didn't have professional baseball out there.
Okay. Obviously you played baseball when you were young.
Yeah.
Did you have any brothers or sisters who played?
No, I had no brothers or sisters either.
How about your dad?
No, my dad never played either.
Well, how did you get interested in it?
Well, playing around the summertime, you know, playing with the kids and started playing baseball. And finally, when I was a junior in high school, the town team asked me to come out and work out with them, which I did. And we had a town team, just pickup town team, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I joined them.
And you played other towns.
And we played other towns, little small towns around the country.
Were you always a pitcher?
I played first base when I went pitching.
And when did you develop the underhand?
When I first started playing any kind of baseball was in college.
Where did you go to college?
Kansas State University.
In Manhattan?
Yeah, Manhattan. And I had always thrown overhand, but I played football at Kansas State. And before the first game, I had my shoulder, what we call a knockdown shoulder. I think today it'd be a separation, but they just called it knockdown then. And later on, I had a similar problem. And when I finished school, I was throwing sidearm. And when the Tigers signed it, I was throwing sidearm. And when I went to Detroit right after I graduated on June the 1st, I was up there about 10 days in Detroit pitching batting practice, and they sent me down to Decatur in the 3I League. And there was a manager down there, Bob Colvin, who was quite well known in the minor leagues as a manager. He was a great guy for young kids, you know. And he watched me throw batting practice when I got there. And he said to me, he said to Eldon, he said, you know, if you're going to pitch in the major leagues, you've got to get the ball over the plate. And he said, most sidearmers have trouble hitting that 17-inch target from 60 feet and 6 inches. And he said, I would like to see you throw directly underhand so you'll line up with the plate. He said, when you're throwing out to the side, he said, you're cutting at that plate, throwing the plate at an angle. And he said, I'd like to see you throw directly underhand and line up with the plate. He said, I think you'd have better control. He said, you've got a good fastball and a good curveball. And he said, there was another pitcher for the Yankees, Carl Mays, had pitched for the Yankees years ago, and he threw directly underhand. He's the guy that killed the Cleveland player.
Cool.
Yeah, he hit him in the head. Ray Chapman, I guess it. And so I'd never heard of him or anything like that. So I pitched batting practice for 4 or 5 days, and Quincy was leading the league. And they were coming to town, and Bob said to me, he said, Eldon, he said, you're going to pitch the game against Quincy. He said, you're going to pitch the entire ball game. I don't care how many men you walk or how many hits you got from me. He said, you're out there for 9 innings or 10 or whatever it's going to be. And I don't want you to throw any other way except underhand, which I did. Well, I shut him out, and I struck out some like 14 or 15 men, and we won the ball game 1-0 or 2-0. And I never threw any other way since then.
Impressive debut.
Yeah.
Can we just go back to Kansas State a minute?
Yeah.
You did play on the Kansas State baseball team?
Yeah. I lost 2 games. I lost one to the University of Oklahoma and one to the University of Missouri in the 3 years out there.
And I guess you probably made a little conference.
Steve O'Rourke signed in with the Tigers.
He's a scout?
But yeah, he was a scout for the Tigers. Casey Stengel was a scout for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And Casey wanted me to sign with the Dodgers. But O'Rourke said, well, he said, I think you've got a better chance getting the major leagues with the Tigers because they're building a young team and Brooklyn's got an old team, got a bunch of old pitchers, and he said, I think you'll do better if you join.
This was around 1931, I guess.
I graduated in June 1932, and I went from there, graduation, right to Detroit.
And then right to Decatur?
Yeah.
32, okay.
Yeah.
And, okay, you won that game, but then it looks like your record was 1-6 in that league.
In what league was that?
And that was Decatur, Three Islands.
Was it? I don't remember.
Then you went to Moline later that year.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, the league went broke. Yeah, the league went broke.
And you went to Moline in the Mississippi Valley.
That's right.
I guess that obviously is down in the south.
Okay, yeah.
Mississippi. Had you ever been that far away from home before?
Well, just in college when we played football and basketball. I played football and basketball. That's
three, three
sports. And we played, all of West Virginia in football. Bo McMillan was our coach out there. Football was my sport. In fact, my last year in football, Bart Nagurski and another guy came out from Chicago and wanted me to sign a contract with the Bears. They offered me a contract for $500 a game and a 12-game guarantee, which is $6,000.
I guess that was a lot of money.
And I signed the contract with the Tigers for $450 a month. But I was just trying to get money to get back to go to school. I went to school and I graduated pre-med, and I wanted to be a doctor, and I didn't have any money to go to medical school, so I was just trying to earn money to go to medical school.
Did you get such a thing as bonuses in those days?
No bonuses. Just the opportunity.
Okay, so after that, then the next year, 1933, you went to Beaumont in the Texas League.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who was the manager there?
Bob Coleman.
Same.
Yeah, Bob Coleman.
Bob Coleman, okay. And that was a good year, 16 wins, 10 losses.
Yeah, I don't remember that.
Do you remember any of the players you played with or against who went on to prominence in that
game? Yeah, Claude Paschal was my roommate. Claude ended up, I think, with Chicago. He was originally signed with the Tigers, and he hurt his arm. And then I lost track of him after I went to the Tigers. And he later came up with the Cubs, I believe it was, and he was in Philadelphia. And I haven't seen him since then.
He pitched that one hitter in the 45 World Series.
Yeah. Claude ended up, he was, before he hurt his arm, when he first came up. In fact, we got to Beaumont. He got to Decatur. He went to Millsaps College, and he got into Decatur the night before I arrived the next morning by train, and he called me rookie.
Yeah, seniority by a few hours.
And we were roommates all the time from there on. Very good friends.
Okay. Now later that year, you came up to Detroit.
Yep.
Towards the end of the year.
Yes.
Can you remember your first game?
My first game, I believe it was against Chicago. I went into relief against Teddy Lyons. I met the team in Chicago, and I believe the day I arrived, they sent me to the bullpen, and I went into relief somewhere in about the third or fourth inning, and that was my first.
Now, when you arrived in the major leagues, were you the only submariner?
Yes.
At that time?
Yeah.
During your career, were there any others while you were playing?
No, not directly.
So you
not
were
directly.
Very unique.
Yeah, they've been, Quinsbury was close to it.
But that was well after.
That was a long time afterwards, yeah.
Okay. So that first year you came up 3-3. You know, 3 wins, 3 losses.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember those records.
Okay, right. Then the next year, 1934, that was a good year.
Yeah.
15 wins, 7 losses.
Yeah. We won the pennant that year.
You want to tell us, you played for some well-known players.
Well, see, like Steve O'Rourke said, Detroit Tigers was building the ball club. 33 was Bucky Harris was the manager, and that was the year that when I came up, Greenberg came up, Schoolboy Rowe, Gerald Walker, Pete Fox, JoJo White. I believe Marvin Owen, if I'm not mistaken. And we all came up the same year. And Cochran came over at the beginning of the 34 season from Philadelphia. And when we were in spring training in Lakeland, that was our first year in Lakeland, Cochran started talking to us about winning a pennant.
Cochran was the manager.
Yeah, and a catcher.
Playmaker.
Yeah, play manager. And, of course, none of us ever been in the World Series or ever thought about anything like that, but he talked us into it, so we won the pennant.
And how about that pennant race? Was there any, wasn't going away, or was it a
No, it was with fighting the Yankees. Yeah, we won it. I forgot. It was a pennant race in the National League. We had won the pennant about 10 days before, 8 or 10 days before the season was over. And that was the year that the Giants were leading the league, and they went into the last series against Brooklyn. And the Cardinals were four games behind. Well, they were three games behind. And anyway, the Dodgers, the Giants went into Brooklyn, and Brooklyn beat them all four games. And it ended up with the Cardinals, the Gas House Gang, winning the pennant. We were upset about that because we thought we were going to go to New York for the series and play on the Polo Grounds, where we'd have gotten more money, you know, it's been a better series, more money series.
Was that the year that Bill Terry made the comment, is Brooklyn still in the league?
That's right, that's right.
Probably cost him the pennant.
Yeah, but it cost him the pennant, that's right. And the Cardinals won it. And I pitched a game in Chicago, in St. Louis. I beat him there and beat Carlton. And then started the game, the last game. We went to a seven-game series. And then I started the seventh game against Dizzy Dean. And that's the one he shut us out. They beat us 11-0, I think it was.
Was that the series that the Deans, his brother and him and Dizzy both won two games?
Yes. That's right. That's the year. Yep.
And that was the year. Tell us about the Joe Medwick incident late in that game.
Well, that had a lot. It made a lot out of it. But what happened was it was a play at third base, and Medwick went in to Marvin Owen. And I guess Marvin thought he came in a little high. He hit his foot went up and hit him in the shoulder and tore his shirt. And Marvin took the ball and tried to stuff it down his neck, I guess. And they got into a little scuffle. Well, they were separated. Didn't mean anything. It's a good thing, because Medwick would have killed Marvin Owen. Marvin Owen wasn't very... He was a tall, skinny kid, you know, and he was not a fighter. But what had happened was that the people in Detroit were all really up for that series. Detroit had been in the doldrums during the Depression. When I went there in 1933, people were lined up for soup lines, you know, trying to get something to eat. And the guys working on the lines and Ford, General Motors, were making, I think, 25 cents an hour. And the Tigers hadn't been doing very well the year before. Buck Harris had been there, and we finished sixth or seventh or something like that. But anyway, when we won the pennant, the town just absolutely went crazy. And it brought them up. It just woke up Detroit. And then when we played the Cardinals, we were just supposed to win them. I just assumed we were going to win the series. And so did Detroit. Well, we fooled around and got into a seventh game. And the people had been waiting outside to buy a ticket for the seventh game, and some of them had been out there all night long, you know. And they had their breakfast with them and their lunches and so on. and cushions and everything else. And when they finally got in the ballpark, started the ball game, they were really, the excitement was really high. Well, when this incident took place at third base, the fight started. Medwick, after the fight, started to go out in the left field. Well, the people were so upset at it because he was picking on our third baseman that the people started throwing stuff at him that they brought out to eat. You know, bananas and sandwiches, and they were throwing everything at him. And so finally, Judge Landis was there, and he finally got out of his seat and came out, and he had to go out and take Medwick out of the game. But it was more of a psychological thing than anything else, from the standpoint of the people, because the people were very let down.
Yeah, they were frustrated.
They were killing us. Well, they were killing us. They were frustrated, and everything went wrong. Everything went wrong in that thing. I left the ball game in about the third inning or fourth inning. It's nothing to nothing. I got the bases loaded, and two men out, fresh hit, get a ball off of Greenberg's glove, rolled down the side into a drainage ditch, a little drainage, concrete drain that was there, and Pete Fox came in and slipped and kicked the ball down to the dugout. Cochran finally ended up fielding the ball down for the dugout, and three runs scored. They took me out, put in Schoolboy, I think it was, and then Tommy Bridges, and I think they got seven runs in that inning. It just all broke apart. And then, of course, Diz, he was in good shape that day, and we didn't do anything. We couldn't get the ball out of the infield. And he beat us, I think, 11 to nothing. So the people were really upset.
Okay. Now, what kind of salary were you getting once you got into the majors?
Well, I signed for $450 a month. And I really can't recall what I was making. I was probably making maybe 600 or something like that when the season started. I don't know, maybe more than that. But maybe I was making $1,000. I forgot. But about six weeks into the season, why, Mr. Navin gave me a $2,500 bonus, and then I got another $2,500 bonus later. And so I was probably making $8,000, something like that.
It wasn't bad for that,
or 34.
Because of the depression.
No. After the 35 season, well, I said I was making $11,000. And when the 35 season came around, Mr. Navin had died, and Mr. Briggs had taken over the ball club. And they sent me three contracts, and I sent them back unsigned. And I was living in the winter. My wife and I lived in Lakeland, Florida. That's where we trained that winter. And they sent me the three contracts, and I sent them back unsigned. And I got a call from Mr. Briggs' secretary, Shevlin. Johnny Shevlin, and wanted to know if I'd come to Miami and talk to the old man, talk to Mr. Briggs about the contract. Well, he was a paraplegic, you know, and he hadn't walked in 10 years. So I went down to his house in Miami. Got out on the boulevard there. But anyway, I went in his office, and he said, why didn't you sign those contracts I sent you? And I said, well, it wasn't enough money. He said, how much money do you want? And I said, I want $15,000. Well, he started swearing, and I thought he was going to walk out of the room. And I got him started to leave, and he says, well, where are you going? I said, well, you asked me a question. I said, you get all upset. I said, no, you should be sitting here. He says, sit down. He called Joe Shovel. He says, give him a contract for $15,000. So I know that was that's why they would get paid in 1935.
Right. Now, when you came in, if you came in 33, was Babe Ruth still around?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us maybe some of the players you...
Well, in fact, our first trip when I joined the Tigers, we went right after I got there, we went, made the Eastern Swing. And that was when Harris was there, Buck Harris. And so we go to New York out of Detroit, and Bucky sent me the bullpen. And we had a pitcher named Carl Fisher who was pitching, and he got in trouble in about the third inning, I think it was, or something like that. And they called me in from the bullpen, and I loosened up, and Ruth was the first hitter.
Oh, my God.
And I threw four pitches.
That's the first player you pitched
hitter,
against in the Navy.
First in the Yankee Stadium. The first guy I faced in the Yankee Stadium. First time I was ever in New York, the first time I ever saw Yankee Stadium. I struck him out on four pitches. And then I got Gehrig out, and then I finished up the ballgame. I got to know Dave pretty well. I used to play golf with him in Florida. We had a bunch of guys who played down here, Dizzy Dean and Wes Farrell and Mickey Cochran and a bunch of us. We used to play golf in the wintertime, and Dave used to play with us all the time. We played with him about 3 years. But,
okay, so now next year, 1935, you earned your money. 18 wins, 7 losses.
Yeah.
Best percentage in the league.
Yeah, that's right.
And did you have a pennant race that year?
Pardon?
Was there a pennant race that year, or Detroit won?
Well, we won the pennant and won the World Championship that year.
Yeah, well, I mean, but was it a close race? Was it a close pennant
no,
race?
No. Well, we were fighting the Yankees. I forgot when we won it. We won it plenty of time, though. I think we won about a week or 10 days before.
Right.
I don't remember exactly what it was.
You want to tell us about the World Series that year?
Hey, what?
Tell us about the World Series in 35.
Yeah, well, that's, we played the Cubs. And we opened up 2 games in Detroit. And I think we won one and lost one, if I'm not mistaken. Lon Warnicke, I think, beat Schoolworth, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, I opened up in Chicago. We went 2 games in Detroit, then we went to Chicago. And I opened up in Chicago against Bill Lee, who had led the National League in pitching that year. And we both went to the, I think, 7 innings. They were tied up 2-2. We were both taken out for pinch hitters. And then we ended up winning the ball game in the 12th inning, I think it was. But then I was scheduled to pitch the 7th game if it went 7 games. But we won it in 6 games. The 6th game we won it. So it
which was okay with you.
No, it didn't. Pardon?
Which was okay
well,
with you.
Well, quicker the better. Quicker the better. Yeah.
Now, with your underhand pitch, was there any kind of, I guess, could there have been some criticism or something of the fact that you were pitching so much differently than everybody else?
Well, some of the hitters had problems with it. Ruth told me, as did Joe DiMaggio, they both told me that they had trouble picking up a pitch on the delivery. I had pretty good success with Joe, and he told me we were end up being good friends, and I talked to him quite a lot, and he said to me, he said, I just can't pick up your pitch. He said, I can't. He said, the way you're delivering it. He said, I can't pick it up. So it's right on top of it. And Ruth had the same problem. He told me the same thing when we played golf. And of course, I pitched against him in 33, 34, and 35, I think. And then he quit. No, let's see. He went to Boston in 35. I think it's 33 and 34. But some of the guys had trouble, some others didn't.
Tommy Hendrick mentioned you. I interviewed him last year.
Yeah, Tommy. Yeah. Yeah, Tommy. I had trouble with Tommy. He could hit me at night, I think.
He said that. He said he was the only Yankee that really had kind of success against you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I had pretty good luck with the Yankees, but I couldn't get that Hendrick out of the He hit me.
You had a fastball. What other pitches did you use?
A curveball and screwball. Yeah.
Did you have any problem with umpires?
With umpires? No. No, we had good umpires. No, we had a lot of good umpires. The league. No, I never had any problem with the umpires.
Who are some of the better umpires?
Bill Summers, Bill McGowan, George Moriarty, Cal Hubbard. Harry Geiser was a pretty good one. I can't remember the rest of them.
All right, so 1936, Won 13, lost 16.
In 36?
36, right.
I won 13, lost 16?
Right.
I did?
Yep.
I didn't realize that.
But next year you came back 17-9.
That was in
37.
Let's see, 36, that was the year that Cochran got hit in the head.
Changes, changes career. Yeah. Yeah. And
then Who was
the
fellow
that threw the pitch?
Bump
Hadley.
Yeah.
And then in 1938, you were 11-10.
No.
And 1939, you were with Boston.
That's right.
How did that happen?
Well, Marvin Owen retired, third baseman. And they needed a third baseman. And Boston wanted some pitching, and they had Pinky Higgins as their third baseman. And they had a young guy coming up,
Jim Tabor
coming up. And so they had two third basemen, so they traded me for Pinky. Pinky came to Detroit, and I went to Boston. That was a bad year for me.
They had 9-10.
Cronin was a playing manager and played shortstop. And Joe was a very nervous type of guy. Joe was a nice person, but he had a habit of running out on the pitcher's mound and telling you how to pitch. And I found out that after a game, my first game, I guess it was, I found out that he was giving the signs to the catcher whether I should throw a fastball or a curveball or whatever pitch to make. That was completely different than I've been pitching for 6 years. Mickey Cochran had this philosophy. He told us that, he said, look, I'm the manager and I'm the catcher, but he said, when you're on that pitcher's mound, he said, it's your ball game. And he said, don't you ever throw a pitch at me that you don't want to throw. He said, you shake me off anytime you want. If they hit it out of the ballpark, it's your fault. If they strike out, well, he says, that's my fault. But he said, don't you ever throw something you don't want to throw. Well, I went over to Boston, and that's the way I worked. I've been in the league for 6 years, and been fairly successful. And I got over there in Boston, and Joe, he didn't mean anything by it. He didn't aim to get you upset, but he kept running in from the pitch, from the shortstop, and he'd run out and pick up the rosin bag, and he'd say, make him hit the fastball, make him hit the curveball, you know, keep the ball down on him, pitch him inside, pitch him outside. And about the third game, he had me absolutely crazy. And, I'd worked in a ball game against the Yankees, against Gomez, about the third inning, and he'd been out there, Joe's been on the mound more than I was, practically. And when he came in this time, I was so upset, Joe come running in. Before he got there, I said, here, Joe, I said, you take the ball, you pitch, and I'll play shortstop. How about that? I never pitched again for 27 days. I probably should have talked to Joe and kind of got things straightened out. But he had the other pitchers the same way. Everybody but Lefty Grove. Lefty Grove, when Cronin started for the mound, Grove would walk to the dugout. He wouldn't even talk to him. But we had Jack Wilson and Fritz Oscar Miller. Some of the guys, I've seen Jack Wilson walk off the mound crying. He was a good pitcher. But Joe just couldn't help it. He thought he was just trying to help me, you know. He wanted to do this. So I had it was a bad season. I just didn't enjoy it. I was upset most of the year with him. I just couldn't walk on the mound and concentrate on what I was doing with him running back and forth on the mound. And I told him, I said, Joe, I said, God, just stay away from me. See? But he wouldn't do it. He just kept it up. So when the season's over, when Mr. Yawkey called me, and he said, Eldon, he said, we want to sign you up for next year before the season, so we don't have to maybe any letters. And again, Eddie Collins, the general manager, I said, well, Mr. Yawkey, I said, you don't want me here next year. I can't do you any good. I said, be wasting your money and my time. And I said, you just signed Joe Cronin to a 5-year contract. And I said, I just can't take one. So I said, I just want to be truthful with you. I'm not going to tell you that I'd like to play in Boston, but I can't play with Joe managing the ball club. And so I said, you can either trade me, sell me, or I'll quit. Well, I got a call from Fred Haney over in St. Louis, who was the manager of St. Louis Browns. Fred called me about 3 weeks later, and he said, I just talked to Tom. He said, I have a permission to talk to him. He said, would you pitch for me over here? I said, I'll pitch for anybody. Let me pitch the ball game. He said, you come over and you pitch the ball game. So I went to St. Louis in 1940, and I won 16 ball games that year, I think.
Right, 16 and 11.
If you look up your records, you'll also find that the Boston Red Sox finished in fourth place, 8 games out of first.
It might have made a difference.
So it might have made a difference if Joe had stayed off the pitcher's mound.
Right.
But he couldn't stay off.
Going back to Boston a minute, did Ted Williams come up?
That was his first year.
And what was
his first year?
What was your impression or the team's impression?
Well, he was he'd just broken all the records in the American Association history, I think, when he came up there. He had a wonderful year in Minneapolis. And so he came down there with a lot of statistics behind him that he could hit that ball, which he could. And he was just a young kid. He just turned 20, I think. And he didn't smoke, didn't drink, and he was just a big kid, liked to drink Coca-Cola and make a lot of noise. And swing that bat. And he was just a kid on the club. In fact, we just called him a kid. And he acted like a kid. He was kind of immature. But he could play baseball. He could hit. And surprisingly, he never got credit for it, but Ted was a good outfielder. One of the things about Ted was he took such long strides. And he also studied the hitters. Ted was a student of the game. In spring training, he drove about us pitchers. That drove us all crazy because he was always asking about the opposing pitchers. You know, what kind of a pitcher is running? You know, is it a fastball, a good pitcher, curveball? What's his best pitcher? Goldman, what about him? How about Teddy Lyons? You know, how about Tommy Bridges? What about this curveball? You know, just going, he just drives you nuts talking about it. And I think when the season opened, he knew more about the pitching staff in the American League than some of us have been in the league for years. But Ted was a student of the game, and he watched the hitters when we played the opposing team. And he got himself in position. Nobody, no coach or anyone on the bench ever had to move Ted Williams in the outfield. He moved himself. That was something that he studied the hitters and he knew where to go. And as a result of that, he didn't get the credit for the kind of fielder he was. He didn't make the run and dive and catch when guys were out of position in the outfield. They should have been, you know, farther to the right than they were over to the left. And in order to they either got a hit or else they made a dive and catch to save it. Well, it had been Ted had been standing there and caught it in his glove, very easy. But he wasn't given credit for it, and he had an excellent arm. Ted could throw very accurate. In fact, I think he started out as a pitcher, if I'm not mistaken. But Ted could throw very accurate arm, and never threw to the wrong base. I never saw Ted Williams ever throw to the wrong base. He was like DiMaggio never threw to the wrong base.
Okay, back to the Browns, 1940. They were one of the lesser teams in the league.
I think when I went there, we were in sixth place. Yep.
Who were some of the players?
Well, George McQuinn at first base. Don Hefner was second. Johnny Berardino came up as shortstop. And another shortstop that's been around, Alan Strange. Been around. Harlan Cliff was a third base. We had Walter Zednik and Rip Radcliffe, been around for a while. Joe Grace was an outfielder and building a catcher once in a while. Bobby Swift was the catcher, and we had Rick Farrell as the catcher.
Pitching?
And we had Johnny Nakeling.
A knuckleballer.
Yeah, a good one. He didn't get the credit. He was a pretty good pitcher. They later got, I think it was in 41, they got Danny Dalehouse. Bob Moncrief and Bob Harris. And I can't think of the other guy's name. Johnny Allen joined us from Cleveland. He came over.
Okay, then in 1941, you were 14 wins and 15 losses with the Browns. And 1942, 14 and 13.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was your last year in the majors.
Yep.
Were you involved with the service? I mean, did they draft
you? No. In the winter of 1938, I stayed in Detroit. I didn't go down south. And I went to work for a company. I got to thinking I wasn't going back to medical school, and I didn't know what I was really going to do when I quit ducking the line drives. And so I wanted to get into something, business. And so I got in, I went with a company called Midwest Abrasive Company. They made bonded abrasives. And that was 1938. And I worked in the plant in the wintertime to kind of learn the business. And in 1939, I started working in the engineering department. And in 40, I started working on anti-aircraft guns. The war was warming up, you know, and our planes were all armed with 75 caliber machine guns, and the Germans were arming theirs with these 20 millimeter cannons, and also the Navy, the smallest anti-aircraft gun they had, the old philosophy of bombing was when the plane would drop bombs from a high altitude, and the Germans were doing this dive bombing, running into the planes and dropping their bombs, and we didn't have anything but a 3-inch gun, which was hard to maneuver. So we come up with a 40-millimeter gun, which was a Gatling-type gun, and that took care of the dive bombers. That was a very attacking plane. That was devastating for them. It fired just like a machine gun. It was built like a Gatling gun. And then we armed all of our planes, all of our fighters, with 20-millimeters. And I started on that program in the winter of 1940. And when the winter of 1942 rolled around, I was working with 27 gun arsenals over the United States and Canada. And so when the 42 season was over, I said, look, I wasn't eligible for the draft. I was married, had a child, I was 32 years old. And we were in the war effort right up to our ears. And so I stayed on the job. St. Louis, I don't retire. I quit after 42 seasons. And I stayed, worked on anti-aircraft all during the war.
Very successful.
Then, when the war was over, then I went into business in Detroit with the company. And then I joined another company later and was regional manager for them. And then in 1953, they wanted to go down east to Westboro, Massachusetts to take over as general sales manager, which I did. And then I was vice president of marketing for several years. And then my last 8 years in business before I retired, I was president of the company. The last 8 years. We ended up as the second largest in the business.
Did you still keep your home in Florida, or are you...
No,
during this period, did you still keep your home in Florida?
No, we lived in Massachusetts for 24 years. That's where our plant was located. And we lived there, but we had plants in Canada and California and Denmark and Luxembourg and Cheltenham, England, and I was all over, but we lived in Westboro, Mass. That's where our headquarters were.
Okay. throughout your baseball career, what would you call your biggest thrill in baseball?
Oh, I don't know. It's, I guess probably the biggest thrill, I think, was when we won the pennant the first year. Not from an individual standpoint. That's more from a team standpoint, which was thrilling, because we were all a bunch of kids, you know, and we won that pennant, and that was a really big deal for the team. And I don't know whether, as an individual accomplishment, I guess maybe I put the, I don't know, maybe, I think if the records show that on September the 21st, I think in 1934, I believe, I think I shut out the St. Louis Browns 2-0, and that sinks the pennant. That was one of them. I think that the record showed it. It's either 34 or 35. And then, of course, I beat the Cards, my first World Series game. I beat the Cards over in St. Louis. And then, of course, they beat me the seventh game. It's hard to pick out one single thing.
Do you keep in touch with any of the ex-players? Are there any still around there?
Oh, yeah. I keep in touch. Ted Williams, I'm very close to Ted. He lives over on the other coast of Florida, and I go and see him right along. And we've been on two or three deals together. We went in New York together here last summer, and he came down for opening day of the Dodgers. He came down here. Thomas Gordon and I was with him, and we flew him back home. And I'm close to Tommy Lazarda. Tommy and I are very good friends. Of course, we never played together, but with his manager, with his with the guy, I've got to claim with him. But there's only, I keep in touch with only ones that are alive in our 35 World Series. Well, 35 World Series, they're champions. There are only four of us alive. And,
who else is that?
Well, we had a left-handed pitcher, relief pitcher named Hodson, Chief Hodson. He's out in Kansas. He's in a rest home, and he weighs about 135 pounds now, and he has Alzheimer's disease. And Billy Rogel was our shortstop. He's in Detroit, and he's in a rest home. He's 95. Ray Hayworth is in North Carolina, and I keep in touch with Ray and Billy by telephone. And Ray was my first catcher in the major leagues, and he's in a rest home, and he's 90. He's 96. And so then, an interesting thing about Ray Hayworth, his grandson is J.D. Hayworth, who is the United States representative from the 6th District of Arizona, and he's in Washington. He's a great guy, J.D. Hayworth. If you know anything about politics, or you'll be hearing a lot about him.
Okay.
He's great. Well, he's the Ray Hayworth grandson.
How is baseball different today than when you played it? What do you think the major difference?
Oh, it's been a lot of changes made. I think the biggest change that I see is probably in the way the pitchers are handled. I won, I think, 130 ball games, something like that. 131, I think, counting World Series. And I pitched, I think, about 126, 127 complete ball games. And that's something that has changed completely. Today, is that right?
I have 130 on the record, but
yeah.
Not the World Series game.
Well, the World Series game. But anyway.
Close enough.
Yeah, anyway, that's something that is sort of in the past right now. Oral Hershiser is a good friend of mine. I talked to Oral here a couple of years ago. He asked me how many complete games I pitched, and I told him. He said, my God, he says, I wouldn't win that money if I pitched over 60 years old. He said, I couldn't pitch that many complete games. The management and the handling of the pitching staff has changed a lot, because Mr. Navin, when I came up with the Tigers, Mr. Navin said, look, he said, we're bringing you up here as a starting pitcher. And he said, when you walk out on that mound, he said, I expect you to pitch the entire ballgame. He said, was it 9 innings, 10 innings, or what? He said, I don't have much money. He said, I can't afford to pay you to start a game and have two or three other guys pay them to finish it. So he said, when you go out there, I want you to pitch 9 innings. That was his philosophy, and that was my philosophy. So I tried my best. Last time I didn't finish.
But it's not necessarily a good thing like that, because I can remember when Whitey Ford used to get criticized for not completing any game. He would leave the league right now if he were pitching his totals.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, I mean, is that really a good thing or bad thing? I mean, did it make your arm more sore to have to pitch those extra innings?
No. I never had a sore arm in my life. A lefty grow was probably the epitome that of pitchers that proves that throwing does not hurt your arm. You keep that arm in shape. Of course, most important thing, keep your legs in shape. This is what I think is wrong today. One of the big things is these kids are having these pulled groins. I saw something the other day. This young Percol, I think it is, a young shortstop.
Yes, yes.
With
the Braves.
With the Braves. 19 years. Better yarn. You keep your legs in shape, you're not going to hurt your arm.
Recently there was a movie put out called The Life and Times of Hank Greenberg.
Yes.
Did you get a chance to see it?
Yes, I have a copy of it.
Copy?
Yes, the girl that produced that.
Oh.
I had interviews, about a 2-hour interview with the group that made that film. They came down to Vero Beach.
That bring back some memories?
Yeah. I played Hank for 6 years. Great guy, very close friend. I knew his dad and mother and his brother Joe and his sister, and I know Steve, his son, and Greenberg have been good friends of ours. His dad and mother are great people. Hank was a wonderful person. I think they did a good job on that film. They kind of stressed, I think, just a little bit too much about the ethnic end of it, because Hank was never on our ball club. Hank was one of us. We were just like brothers. Right? If I'd had a brother, I wouldn't love him more than I did Hank Greenberg, because he was just a great guy. And we were all that way, you know. And we never, ever had anything like this ever come up. I never heard the stand. When we were in Detroit, Hank was a very popular man. Of course, he was a great ball player. That's what made him, you know, beside himself. Hank was a real gentleman. Everybody loved Hank, and I don't think I ever heard anyone in Detroit ever say a detrimental word about Hank Greenberg. And I think the film played it up just a little bit too strong, you know. Steve sent me some clippings from after they showed it in New York, from the newspaper clippings, and one of them said Hank Greenberg played for himself and for the team and for the Jewish people. And maybe he did. But when he was playing, he was thinking no more than I thought. My background was German, and I played for the German people, you know. But I know that on one occasion, I forgot what holiday it was. I was pitching against Boston, and it was, I don't know what it was. The question of whether Hank was going to play or not.
Either Russian, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah.
Whatever it was. I don't know what year it was. Anyway, he decided to play. It was 35. And he didn't take batting practice. But I remember that day very well, because I pitched the ball game against Boston. I shut him out. We beat him 2-0. Hank Greenberg hit 2 home runs.
I remember that very well. His son is a baseball official, isn't he?
Steve, well, he was the assistant commissioner. But he's out of it now. He's been in some kind of TV work. Done very well, I understood.
Now, I understand you had a part to play in the last game at Tiger Stadium last year.
Yes.
Tell us about
Well, I was invited up along with 65 other Tigers. And it was the closing of the stadium. And they had the closing ceremony was they took the flag from center field, and all the players lined up from center field to home plate. And they passed the flag one from the other. They took the flag down for the last time, and they passed the home plate. And I was the last one to receive it. And then I gave a little talk. They asked me to give a talk.
Was it planned that you would be the last one?
Yes. And then I presented the flag to Brad Osmus, who was the captain of the Tigers, this year's Tigers, and catcher. And I told him that, well, my speech was ended up that he was to keep the flag until we opened up the new ballpark at Comerica Park. And so that was the last thing that took place. And after my speech, then he gave a little talk, and then Ernie Harwell come on and had closed the park. And this year, when they opened this year, Johnny McHale called and told me when they come up, and they asked myself and let's see who else, Kaline, and a couple more. There's only four of us were there, and they asked me if I would go to center field, and they passed the flag back. The others, the 65 weren't there, but they took the
current player,
Little League, and all the politicians in Detroit and all of them, and it was passed to the commissioner, and then the commissioner gave it to Brad and me, and then they raised the flag. Yeah, nice on him. Yep.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much. It has been very enlightening. And,
thank you. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks a lot, and I'm glad Fellas Save remember.
Well, it's been a long time since some of those things I thought I even thought about.